and I'm interviewing Shirley Mackay, a retired administrator and Inland Revenue person, about the life and times of her family. Shirley, would you like to carry on?
Yes, thank you, Frank. I think I would like to actually point out that I've been quite fortunate doing genealogy and finding that all my ancestors that came to New Zealand all came into Napier. They all sailed into Napier. So I've been fortunate there that I haven't had to go all over the country to find them. And we're also fortunate in that their shipping records were saved from the earthquake and are now still in Napier. So my father's family was the Painters, and they came from the UK. Henry Painter came from the UK in 1876, and they sailed on the Inverness. He actually had been married before. His wife had died over in, I think it was the Forest of Dean. They actually lived where he, at the time, was a coal miner in the mines over there. And when she died, he was left with a son and a daughter. And I think at some stage, just reading different histories that I've been able to find, that the lady that he did eventually marry again, her name was Mary Ann Keir, and I think she might have gone to housekeep for him and his children. And they also, at the time they were in the mines, they had extended family living with them as well. So they must have had quite a houseful. Now, in 1876, when they came over on the ship, Mary Ann was with them, but they had also, obviously, lived together as husband and wife because they had two little daughters as well. Sure. With them. Her father was William Keir, I think, and her mother was Eliza James. Now, she actually was, from what I can gather, a very hard-working, affable little lady. And they didn't marry until they were living in Miani. And at that time, his eldest son, Harry Painter, was going to marry an Irish girl, Eliza Brennan. And they did get married in the Miani Church, Catholic Church. And I suspect that at the time, because on the wedding certificate, one of the witnesses was Sister Mary Aubert, and she was a Catholic nun. The family were not Catholics.
Yes.
But I think she must have twigged somehow that the mother and father of Harry were not married. Oh dear, dear. Anyhow, they did get married at their residence, but it was by, I think, an Anglican minister. But the fact that Sister Mary Aubert was there, and she was actually a friend of Mrs. Young, who was a midwife, who used to travel around the country with her, and the Youngs were neighbours of the Painters in the Forest of Dean.
Right.
So there's all sorts of connections
that
happened in those days, and the Painters actually sort of encouraged the Youngs to come out here. Anyhow, I think it was Henry. Yes, Henry had quite a few children all together, and he used to work as sort of, I think, an odd job man and labourer and that sort of thing. And they lived at Miani for some time. And then they later moved, because Miani at that time suffered a lot of floods. And they eventually moved. My grandfather, William Painter, who was Henry's second son, but the only son from the second marriage, he did go to Miani school, but they eventually moved to Whararangi, not too far from where the Taradale Club is now. And they lived there for a number of years, but he apparently suffered badly with arthritis in his hands, and he couldn't work his labour work. And that's when she took over midwifery, and I think she might have learned that from her friend Mrs. Young. And that's how she made a living. But they ended up by having a large family of children as well as grandchildren and all that sort of thing around them. They married on the 25th of July 1881 at Miani, and he died on the 31st of July 1917. And both of them are buried at the Taradale Cemetery up on the hill there. Yeah. So his son, my grandfather, Willie Painter, after leaving school, and I think as was the case in those days, they left school fairly young. He went to work for the Williams family up on the East Coast, and he used to come home occasionally on the boat, but most of the time he lived up there. Yeah. And he ended up by actually working for A.B. Williams, who was pretty well known as up on the coast. He was a great philanthropist, yes, really, A.B. Williams. And my grandfather used to ship the bales of wool, take the bales of wool down to the ships on the coast, because there was no roads in those days as such. And he was persuaded by A.B. to buy his own horses and cart, etc., and contract out as well as A.B.'s farm, contracted out. So he was up there at Waipura Bay, and I always thought of him as a big frog in a little pond. He used to be a great organiser. He organised dances and all sorts of events and that sort of thing. I suppose I should go back, because he did marry a Napier girl, Clara Taylor, and he used to come home, and I've often sort of smiled to myself about his description that he saw this beautiful girl riding a white horse, and he always thought how much he'd like to marry her. Anyhow, he must have pursued her, because they did get married. I think he was about a year to her junior, but he put his age up. Anyhow, they did marry in the registry office in Napier in, I think it was about 1897. And he took her back up to Waipura Bay, and they lived in a little cottage which still stands at Waipura, but it was a very tiny place, and they had to move eventually as their family grew. They had 10 children. 2 children died very young, one as a baby and one as a little boy, who I think got measles, died from measles. The 8 that survived, there was 4 girls and 4 boys, and my father was one of them.
Just before we go any further, where is Waipiro Bay relative to Hicks Bay or Ruatoria?
I did once write a story about the family in Waipiro Bay, which I'd have to go and get. Yeah. But yes, it's not as far as Ruatoria. It's below Ruatoria. There's Tonaga Bay, yes, and then Waipara, or vice versa. Yes. Used to be a freezing works at Tonaga, yes, Bay.
So you're, yes, on the Gisborne side of Hicks,
yes,
Bay.
Yes. It's very picturesque coming down. You drive down now from the main road, and you drive down the side of the hills,
yes,
etc.,
yes,
and come down into Waipara Bay. Right. And it's quite picturesque, yes, coming down,
yes,
in there.
I interviewed another family whose grandparents used to cart wool and all sorts of stuff down the rivers. I have no idea that's how they brought the stuff down,
yes,
because there's no roads, the riverbeds were the roadways.
Yes. No, it was a very different way of life that we can understand now. And when I went up to Gisborne and was delving into a little bit of the history up there and getting into the library, and that the museum up there has got a very interesting, or they did have, of the baskets that people used to, how they used to get onto the ships. A person would sit in this basket and then be hoisted up into the ship. And that's how my grandmother would have been hoisted up the ship to go from Napier to Waipara. And somewhere I've got a sort of a facsimile of what she would have looked like, because,
yeah,
I had taken a photo of that basket, a big square basket. I mean, I would have been terrified, but that's how they did it in those days. Just looking at that basket at the Gisborne Museum, I could only see one person sitting in it, so they must have had to up and down it an awful lot. Perhaps a mother and several children might have been able to fit in it.
Well, they would have only had block and tackles to lift with.
That's how they would have done it.
That's right, and so that would have dictated how many.
Yes, so their cottage actually backed on to the Waipura Bay Cemetery, and I still remember Dad's eldest sister, when I was much younger and not quite into genealogy at the time, my eyes used to go up to the ceiling when she'd start rambling on about the family. But now I wished I'd listened more to her, but I can still remember her telling different things. And the little boy that died of measles, she said, we took his coffin round the road, we gave him a proper funeral. In other words, they didn't put it over the fence into the
cemetery.
They did
it
proper, she said, and they took his casket round the road and in the gate. I think that small cottage they were in, I can understand why they had to move to the larger house, which they did, further up the hill, and they lived there they left there in Waipara in 1914. she would often tell the story about, because they had a horse that was called Lord Nelson because he had one eye, and the kids used to ride this horse, and they lived just below a hill that the kids used to play on, and this hill was called the Fort. And I could sort of envisage in the beginning that would have been a Maori fortification. Anyhow, yeah. They used to take this horse up, ride it up the hill, but the kids sitting on the back of the horse would always fall off. So anyhow, as I say, they lived there and had a remarkable childhood from what I can just glean from the little bits and pieces that she said. Dad never talked about it very deal, but he had a great affinity for it because he kept going back.
So he wasn't working for the Williams family at that stage?
Well, I gather not as such, but he, I think, still had a lot to do with. He would have still taken their wool down to the beach, etc. Yes. But one of Dad's other sisters once told me, because I also did a tape with her before she died, and she told me about the time that A.B. Williams, he brought the first car that they ever saw down into the bay. And from what I gather, it was a steam car. And he wanted to take all the kids for a drive. And they wouldn't know. They were scared stiff of it, she said. No way. We're going to get in that. He was a very, very kind man, A.B., from what I can gather. And family were always very fond of him. Apart from that sort of idyllic childhood that they seemed to have, they had plenty of mates and all that sort of thing.
Sure.
You know, his father, Willie, played a button accordion. And every Sunday, they had to sing Jesus Bids Us Shine with him playing the button accordion.
Yes.
But his wife, Clara, was the one that had the music ability. And she played piano as well as violin. And she taught some of her children to do this. Dad never got much of he used to play piano, but it was just a few tunes he could belt out. But one of his brothers, Mick, he was the one that had the most musical ability and had a dance band and all. And he also played bass fiddle in the Hastings Orchestra at one stage. So he had quite an ability for music. Another brother did play the violin, but not very much, apparently. So she taught them as much as she could. The oldest daughter played piano as well. And coming down the line, I inherited some of that ability because I played in the dance band too. So, you know, it just seems to be the luck of the draw when you get some of these things handed down.
So did you play the piano in the dance band?
Yes.
This was in the Gisborne area? Or?
No. I played here in the Bay, as well as down south, when I lived down south. So it was quite a musical family overall, because we would often have somebody standing around the piano singing with somebody playing, you know.
People either played cards or they stood around the piano singing, or someone sang to them, because there was no radio.
No television, that's for sure. This piano I've got here came from my mother's family, not my father's. My mother's family, and she often used to say that somebody would come in and play the piano and they would be all singing. So it happened in a lot of houses, and that was their entertainment. But anyhow, as far as my father's family is concerned, the father was very much a man unto himself as well. Apparently one day he went into the farrier's shop that was hammering away at horseshoes, and he wanted to have a go himself, wanted to try and find out how to make a horseshoe. And the farrier said to him, "Put this leather apron on." No, I don't need that." Yes, he did, but he rued the day, I would imagine, that he didn't put it on, because a piece of steel flew off the end of the thing and penetrated his lower stomach. So he actually pulled it out himself, but it left an awful wound, and I gather that he got repercussions from that, because he ended up in Auckland having an operation. So I don't exactly know what the timing was, but I think, reading between the lines, that might have been the end of his days at Waipura. He probably could no longer handle the heavy work. So anyhow, they came down, the whole family left Waipura. There was a little bit in the paper about him, Bill Painter, leaving the Bay, and so, as I say, he was well known there. My father would have been roughly, he was born in 1906. So he would have been about 8 when they came, and he intended to go up to Auckland, Bombay way, because he thought there was a farm to buy up Bombay. But anyhow, when they got there, he found it was already sold. So he decided that they would come back down to Hawke's Bay. So he came and he bought an orchard in Louis Street, and they were there for a few years. And the kids, the ones that were still school age, went to Hastings Central. He lived at Havelock also for a while, but eventually came back and lived in the Timona area and used to lease land and grow crops. When my father was growing up, I think he sort of went that way too, was helping. I suppose you could almost say he was a labourer that would help wherever was needed. But one of his sisters married a farmer, Ernie Anderson, who farmed at Wakatū, and that's where my father spent a lot of his time helping out at that farm. So they, I think it was at the time of the earthquake, they erected, I think, a big marquee or something on one of the paddocks. A lot of people went there. But anyhow, that's getting ahead a bit. My father went out to help at Mason Chambers. I think he was employed to cut down a bit of bush or something. And that's where my mother was working. My mother was one of the chambermaids or whatever they were. So that's how they met at the Mason Chambers property.
Isn't that incredible how small the pond is?
Isn't it? Yes. Well, I took my mother back to Tauroa to have a look at it one day, and she said, I used to think it was a castle, but it wasn't.
It was a castle then.
Well, in those days. And anyhow, she was born in Napier to Thomas Durney, and he was an Irishman, came over from Ireland, and they came on the Bevington in 1874. He was married twice as well. So he came over with his first wife, with several children, and then she died in about 1897 or something like that. And again, I think our grandmother was housekeeping for him, because he had quite a biggish family.
Yes, well, they either had to get a housekeeper or they had to marry a new wife.
So we came from the second Durney marriage. She had 5 children to him, but he died of cancer in, I think it was 1911 he died, so she was left with a young family. And my mother's sister was only about 9 or 10 months old. But my mother was born in 1907, so she would have been about 4.
The name Durney, is that associated with the building company that was in Hawke's Bay later on?
The construction company, yes. Yes, Ray Durney was my cousin on that side.
I knew Ray very well. I always got on well with him. He always treated me nicely.
Well, he had a certain arrogance about him. The funny thing about Ray, which often, well, I suppose being his cousin, knowing him fairly well, I could sympathise with him to a certain extent, but he was always very worried of what Phil, his father, would think of him. When he was going through all of the trouble with the construction, etc., he'd sit there almost in tears and say, "Oh God, what would Phil say?" I said, "Well, Phil can't help you, so why worry?"
Yes, that's at the time that crane fell over in Auckland, and
yes,
that sort of upset the apple cart.
So, no, he did go through a bad time.
That orchard he developed on Tiati Road in Havelock North, and the beautiful home he built, I hope he is remembered in history.
Yes, but unfortunately I think a lot of it won't be a good remembering, because he owed so many people money. I mean, that was awful, really. But there was lots of little things that tickled me about Ray. And as I say, there was a certain arrogance about him, etc. And I had done some research into the Durney family, which he was interested in. And and I had found a Durney crest. Oh, that meant a lot to Ray. And he said he wanted to have that Durney crest up on his stables. And I said, "Ray, you're not supposed to use that crest. Okay, it was one of your ancestors, but you're not supposed to use it." I said, "You can have your own crest made, and actually you could probably have, in the one corner of it, you could have an apple tree." My mother was very fond of her brother Phil. I found him a difficult man to know, but then again, I was a kid, really. But my mother said the only thing she had against Phil was that she had to go and do his paper run when he was sick. But anyhow, he was very kind to us as a family too, because like show day, for instance, we would all get bundled onto his truck and taken to the show. So, I mean, they were a big part of our growing up life, the Anderson family and the Dooney family, because of both sides of my parents. So I don't know that I actually mentioned that my mother's mother was Winifred Shanley, and the Shanleys also came into Napier as well, and he came from Exeter way. He was a jeweller, and I think the thing that I can point to him as being of some interest in the Hastings area is that he made the plaque, the bronze plaque, that is underneath the oak tree at the park in the middle of town.
Queen Square.
The plaque that is under that old oak tree, my great-grandfather made. But it's a plaque to the Queen, I think.
So are you related to Colin Shanley then?
I'm not quite sure. I don't think so. I'm not sure. I've never sort of delved into that side a great deal, only to the UK side of it, really. So, and I think maybe the Shanleys might have originally came from Ireland as well. This lot, my grandmother, she was a baby when she came out on the ship with her parents. Again, I think she ended up by being a housekeeper to Thomas Durney and then marrying him. So the Shanleys were Catholic. And when my mother was engaged to my father, it was apparently decided that they would marry in the Catholic Church. At that time, I suppose it was, I don't know whether it was some sort of dispensation for him or not, but he never turned Catholic.
A lot of people were christened Catholics, and you're either Catholic or Anglican. Yes. There was nothing else. Feelings ran fairly high between the various churches.
Exactly. That was one of the questions that I asked my mother. How did your mother feel about you marrying a non-Catholic? And she said, I don't think she liked him to, but she said, I don't think it was because he was a non-Catholic. She wasn't too sure just how her mother felt about her father, but she said apparently spelt it out when she did say to him just prior to their marriage, if you ever knock my daughter about, I'll haunt you. And of course my mother always said she had a very happy marriage, and she said he was a very good husband and a very good father, although we would often dispute the father bit, but because he was a rather gruff man. But anyhow, I mean, sure, he gave us a very stable childhood. So that apparently was how her mother saw him, that he just might be a little bit rough. But anyhow, he wasn't. He turned out to be quite, she would have been quite happy about it, I think, in the end. But anyhow, she gave them a lovely wedding. She lived in a house in Hastings Street. Well, it would have been Thomas's house as well. It was a two-story place, been knocked down since, but it was just along the road from, well, there's still a dairy on the corner, I think. Well, there was a dairy. But anyhow, I do remember it. I do remember going there. But anyhow, she put on a reception for them in that house. And my mother had a lovely wedding. And she had a lovely bride. And her sister was her bridesmaid. But before that, because of the earthquake, and my mother also had had a change of jobs, she had gone from the Chambers household because she was asked to go home and look after the brothers and the boarders, they had boarders, while the mother and her sister went over to Australia to see their brother who had gone over to Australia. That was about 1929, apparently, and when they came back and she was able to go back to work again, which apparently, while she was doing this particular job, she often felt like Cinderella. She felt that she was the one that drew the short straw. But anyhow, when she went to go back to the Chambers property, Mrs. Chambers apologised that she was quite happy with the new housemaid that she did have, and that she didn't have a position for my mother anymore. But she did have a suggestion that she could go to another farming property around on the Tomato Road, the Sunderland property, Undercliff. So Mum ended up at Undercliff, and that's where she was during the earthquake. There is a part where she talks about the earthquake, but it's not what I should have let her say. I chopped her off a wee bit there, but what she told me was that she and the cook, whose name was Edith, somebody, can't remember the other name, used to do the ironing on Tuesdays, washing on Mondays and ironing on Tuesdays. and they were in the process of ironing the big tablecloth for the dining room table, and they would iron from each end towards the middle. And I said, "Oh, did you have electric irons then?" She said, "Yes, we had electric irons." How they entertained one another doing this chore was they would say what pictures they'd been to the previous week, and they would often talk about different pictures, so it was more entertaining. Anyhow, they were in the middle of this when the earthquake happened, and she said they could see out the kitchen door, and the hill, the hills on the paddocks were rolling like the sea, and the trees were rolling like that as well. It was like the top of the trees would often touch the ground. She said all they could think of was they remembered somebody saying, "Or stand in a doorway, that's the safest place." So the two of them were crammed in the doorway, watching all this happening out. And anyhow, after that all sort of was over, and Mr. Sunderland must have come home, he probably was out on the farm at the time, Mum was very worried about what had happened in Napier, because apparently he said that he, from the hills, he could see what looked like smoke, but was probably dust from Napier. So, of course, she was very worried about her family in Napier. And so, anyhow, he said, well, he had a car, and he said, well, he could take her as far as possible in the car. And she was engaged to Dad at the time. So what they did was they went into Wakatu, picked Dad up from the Wakatu farm, and then drove, and they managed to get as far as the Waitangi Bridge. And that was damaged, but the railway bridge wasn't. So he left them there and said he had to get back to his own, and they walked across the railway bridge into Napier. So they went to the Hastings Street house immediately, and so I said, what was that like? And she said, it was a shambles. It was still standing, but it was a shambles inside, but no sign of her mother. So anyhow, they eventually found out by just talking to different people that she had gone to, I think, the Byfords, which was down more towards the outskirts of Napier. Her sister at the time had been working in an office at, I can't remember the name of the place now, but it was down Hastings Street, probably round about opposite where the council chambers are now. I can't remember whether it was a garage or a foundry, something like that. She was working in the office there, and the office wall, which was on the street side, fell outwards. She was very lucky. So she, of course, immediately went home, and she found her mother, and that's when they went down to the Byfords. And, of course, they were later on to be relatives anyhow, because their brother married one of the Byford girls. So anyhow, she eventually, after that, and she saw that her mother was still alive and that she found all her brothers had survived. They were working in town. They were all to do with building, plasterers and that, all that sort of thing. Yes. They were working on buildings in town, and they survived as well. So she was quite happy that the family were still there. So she went with Dad back out to the Anderson property, and that's where they were in a big marquee. I don't know where on earth that came from, but anyhow, they got it. And that's when they heard and saw there was an aftershock after 9 o'clock, and that's when the Grand Hotel came down in Hastings, and they heard it. That was her description of the earthquake. After that, because her mother was so nervous at staying in the house on her own, the family persuaded Mum not to go back to her job, but to stay home with the mother, because they were getting married later in the year. So she stayed home with her mother and wasn't earning any money at all, and she got married in October 1931 to Dad. They were waiting on the train station to get the train down. They were going down south for their honeymoon, and she had a brand new purse, and I mean, she had all the trimmings that a bride needed, etc. And he said, how much is in that purse? Because he could see it was a new one. She said, fourpence. She hadn't earned any money for months. And so she had fourpence. And so he's handed her a pound note, says, here, stick that in with it. Anyhow, when they got back from their honeymoon, they actually lived with Andersons for a while, until next door neighbours called the Holmeses. Next door there was the Gleddells and the Holmes, and then the Andersons on each side of the railway line. The Holmeses had this little cottage. I think their house was damaged in the earthquake. That's right. And they had to live in the cottage until their house was repaired. But after it was repaired, they offered Mum and Dad their cottage. Mm. And Mum and Dad lived there for quite a number of years in this little cottage. And that's when he got work at the Whakatū Works.
So then you would have been quite close to Roy and...
Yes, Valerie, the youngest one, was my age. Valerie often used to, what she often does say, there was big gaps between us kids. Myrtle was the eldest, and then 5 years later Roy came, mm-hmm. and then 5 years later I came.
Yes.
So yes, Valerie and I went to school together. I think I was a few months older than her.
So you went to school where?
At Mangatūra. Yes, I was born at the time where Mum and Dad lived at that cottage,
sure.
in 1934, and I was born in Hastings, and I think it was the maternity annex that was in St Albans Street.
Run by Sister Cooper.
Yes. Wasn't there a Sister Owen as well?
Yes, but Sister Cooper was the boss.
Sister Cooper was the boss, and there was a Sister Owen
that's
as well.
Right.
Yes. Well, that's where I was born. And I think possibly my sister... She came along about 3 years later, and she would have been born there at that time as well. But I think the cottage was starting to get a bit small. And one of the things that sticks in my mind that Mother said was, I got whooping cough as a baby, and this cottage had, of course, a coal range stove. And she kept me in the kitchen with this coal range going all the time, with the warmth, and that obviously helped my whooping cough. So anyhow, we eventually... had to move out to somewhere bigger, and I don't know how on earth they heard about, but this property over in Karamu, which is now Pirari Road, used to be Renita Road, but now it's Pirari Road. So Mum and Dad went over there and rented that house, which was near the corner of Pirari and Karamu, and it was in 1938 on Anzac Day that the place was flooded. There was a huge flood. Of course, I would have been about 4 years old, and Mum said she watched the water from the Karamu stream coming up the road. Anyhow, fortunately, I suppose being Anzac Day, Dad would have been home, which was fortunate, and they were frightened of the water coming in the house, of course, so they started blocking all the furniture up on the blocks of wood, etc., and the carpet. They just had carpet squares in those days, and they blocked everything that they could up on the blocks. Just along the road lived the Lee family, and they had an orchard, and that was more towards Karamu Bridge, and somebody had a rowboat, and they came and got us in the rowboat, and I still can remember being rowed down Karamu Road. I mean, it's an amazing memory to think of, that's a main highway, being rowed in a rowboat down it.
My father always talked about the 38 flood. The water from the Ngarawarra came right to the showgrounds,
yes.
to the railway line. And so it was almost like a sea.
Apparently it was like a sea. And because the Lee house was virtually a house that was, you could almost say it was two-storey, it was high. But I think underneath was just storage. So the house itself was high.
Mm.
And that's where all the community congregated in the highest house. Yeah. So we stayed there overnight. Yeah. And then the water started receding the next day. So we were rowed back again. And fortunately, water hadn't actually got into the house we lived in. It got to the top of the steps, but hadn't actually got in. So Mum and Dad were relieved, of course. And I can still remember seeing all the worms squirming around when the water started receding.
Right.
It amazed me, the thousands of worms. And another thing that was conscious in my memory is seeing my first aeroplane. There obviously must have been, an aeroplane must have gone up to have a look at the damage. So, I mean, it sort of seemed to circle around, and I had never seen an aeroplane. Anyhow, that was a great experience, that, and it's still etched in my memory. Also, I mean, 4 years old, when it was coming time for me to go to school, my next door neighbour, just further along the road, was the Wales family, and Betty Wales was a wee bit older than me, and she used to double me to school. Anyhow, Mum and Dad must have decided that I should have my own bike, and Dad got hold of a bike. It was a half-size bike, not the full size, a half-size bike that he rode back from Hastings.
I wonder his knees didn't get tangled in the handlebars.
He taught me how to ride this bike up and down the road, up and down the road.
Mm.
So that's what I had to get to school, this half-size bike. That was in the family for quite some time. I think it went right through the kids just about. there was five of us. Mum and Dad had five of us kids. And by the time my older brother, I was the eldest, then there was my sister Nolene, then there was Bill or William, and then Philip. And Mum was expecting, I think, Philip at that time. And quite an amazing thing that I've often wondered about, because that was in the 1940s, about 1942, I think he was born. Mum was very worried that Dad was going to be called up. And as it turned out, he wasn't called up because he was retained for essential services because he was at the works. She was apparently carrying very large. And somebody said, "Oh, you're going to have twins." In those days, of course, they didn't have scans, and she, I think she probably worried that she was going to have twins as well. Anyhow, there was a lady that lived down the end of the road, a Mrs. Walsh, and she had some sons. I don't think she had any daughters, but she had sons, and they were all older than me. Anyhow, she was talking to Mum. She must have been walking along the road, and Mum was just talking over the gate, actually, and Mum was telling her all her worries because the owners of the house had asked Mum and Dad to find somewhere else to live because they wanted the property for one of their own. So that was fair enough. They understood that. Mm-hmm. They were given time to find somewhere else to live. But of course, the big worry was where. She had several worries on the line. Dad being called up, and was she having twins, and where were they going to go and live? You see? So anyhow, Mrs. Walsh says to her, "Come along and have a cup of tea with me tomorrow." And she says, "I'll read your tea leaves." And anyhow, Mum went along, and yeah, how old would I have been then? Because I was old enough to remember going. I went with her, and of course my sister went, sister and brother, the whole tribe of us went along, obviously, to have a cup of tea, because I can still remember in that lady's house a crystal ball. Anyhow, she told Mum, "Don't worry, your husband's not going to be called up. You're not having twins. But you will have another child." She did. And she said, "And you're going to move to a house. It's near water, but it's behind a building that has got a very high hip roof." It was the Manga Territory School. And it was a house that was owned by the Barty Smith family. And it was an old house, not too far from the river, not too far from the Karamoo Stream. Yes. And Dad had met Mrs. Barty Smith at a card evening, and he was telling her about their problems. And she said, "Oh, you can have our house." And they must have had a newer house nearer the road. So we moved into that old house. Now, I have ever since thought, how could she tell all of that from tea leaves? But she was a psychic. That's what she was. Yes. She was a psychic. Which, of course, we wouldn't have recognised in those days. No. And I often thought since then, and suddenly the penny dropped some time ago, of course, Mrs. Walsh was a psychic. She couldn't have possibly seen all of that from tea leaves. And everything she said was true. Because the child that Mum had had, again, was our youngest sister, Lois. So anyhow, we lived in that old Barty Smith house. Mum hated it, and I didn't blame her. This week she actually went into town and bought an electric stove. The bathroom was outside, and so was the toilet, etc. But I can still remember him. Did he have a peg leg or something?
Yes, he had a peg leg, a proper peg leg. You could see it.
Yeah, he seemed to be quite a character.
Yes, they had some boys.
She used to wear a lot of jewellery. But obviously a very kind person.
So you were right by school then, weren't you?
Yes. We didn't have too far to go to school. We wouldn't have been there very long, and probably just as well for Mum's temperament, because it was hard work for her, that place. But we were lucky to have a roof over our head. And so my brother was born from there, Philip, and so it was between then and probably round about the next year, about 1943, that Dad was offered accommodation behind the Wakatu Hall if he would be caretaker of the hall. Mm. And of course it belonged to the works. So the accommodation was refurbished. Yes. People had lived in it before. It was all redone and repapered and everything. It was quite comfortable. And it had three bedrooms. So we moved into that. And Mum said she took her electric stove with her.
Good on her.
As far as growing up there, That was a marvellous time because Dad had to keep the dance floor all clean polished. And that, of course, us kids had a wonderful time skating around on sacks, polishing the floor. Yeah. My article that I did for the newspaper some time ago, I called the Pokatū Works a benevolent giant. And I'm sure it was, because living in that community, run by the works virtually, was wonderful. Yes, so that time and living in Waikato and growing up there, I've often thought back how lucky we were. We never starved, we never had hard times at all. It was really a very fortunate bringing up, I think. And of course the works supplied an awful lot of things, like even the tennis courts and the bowling greens, all of that sort of thing. Right. And of course, most of my time was taken up with Dad and the Fire Brigade. He belonged to the Works Fire Brigade. Yeah. And one of the stories, I do remember it, but it was so vague in my memory, but Mum did sort of put me in the picture more. One of the first times the fire siren went up, Dad couldn't find his boots. And he was tearing around, "Where's my boots? Where's my boots?" And Mum found them and then got him to sit down, put them on his feet and started to do up the laces. He said, "What are you doing, Mum?" She says, "I'm doing up the laces." He said, "This is a fire, not a party." So anyway, he tears off to the works. They kept their station at the back of the works because he had to get on his bike and tear down through the back and to the back of the works. And it was a false alarm. Those sorts of times, and of course, being in the hall, etc., the fire brigade, mostly, I suppose, through Dad, and also, like his own father, organised dances. And his brother, Mick, had a dance band, and he would often come out and play for the dancers. Mm. And of course, there was all sorts of different... There was Les Henry used to play, Snow Chaplow.
Gordon Redwood.
Yes. There was all sorts of... Chap Walden, Phil Walden, he used to have a band. There was different bands that used to come and play.
And who ran the Waikato store when you were there?
The Dillons. And then after the Dillons was... Can't remember their name.
The Bradshaws built it, and then they sold it to the Dillons.
What was the name of the people that ran it? Jean was the lady's name. Oh, God. We've got... quite friendly with them. The Dillons were there when we first went there, and then there was this other family. The name will come to me when I'm least expecting it. When Dad was in the fire brigade, they used to organise, again it would have been him, concerts held in the hall for the local Waikatooites. Anyhow, he had this brainwave one day that the men could actually perform a dole dance, but he wasn't quite sure just how to go about it. So he actually approached Ivina Potham, a very well-known dance teacher. Would she teach the men some dance steps to this tune of "Oh, You Beautiful Doll"? Yes, she said she would, but on one proviso, that you perform on a municipal stage, because the fun sessions were still going. Oh, that was a different story. So, of course, he had to ask the men, and Mum says on the tape that these five men... just about had heart attacks. Oh, they think they would perform on stage. Oh, different performing in the Waikato Hall, but... But anyhow, they agreed in the end. So their wives all got together and made their costumes, all out of stock from the Waikato Works, like stocking net and calico and leather or wool. Their wigs were made from wool. Their tutus were made from stocking net and calico. And their slippers were made from leather pelts with coloured bows of calico on them. They were all in different colours. They were green and yellow and blue and pink. And that. So there was five of them all together doing this doll dance. And I can still remember Dad used to use me as the rehearsal pianist, because I mean I was at that stage, well, I was learning piano virtually, but I was able to play the tune "Oh, You Beautiful Doll." So he used me as the rehearsal pianist, and anyhow, when it came to performing on the municipal stage, the men fortified themselves with homemade parsnip wine. Somebody made the parsnip wine. And they got on the stage, and Ivina Potham was supposed to do the singing from the wings, and Dad was miming it. as one of the dolls actually supposed to be singing, but it was her voice that was supposed to be coming over. Well, when the actual time came, she was on the wrong side of the wings, and so she had to tear around the back of the curtains and get onto the right side of the wings, and Dad was just about to open his mouth and start singing because there was nothing coming from the wings. And anyhow, she got there in time when they must have had an orchestra, because the orchestra had started to play. Anyhow, she got there in time to do the singing, so that was fine, but it was touch and go. So that was a great time. We never ever got a photo of it, which was so sad. But we did get photos later on when some of their family virtually did a spoof on it, dressed up like dolls, etc. But that was just a fun thing for the family. All those times were absolutely great as far as my memory is concerned. All my Manga Territory mates, we used to often have our weekends and we'd play together, we'd go down to each other's homes, etc. We'd go down to the Anderson farm and the Dyetts, Jean Dyett, her family had an orchard, and we'd go there too. So it was sort of a time when you never worried about roaming around or getting around at all. No.
So did you go to high school from there?
I went to Napier Girls because at the time I had the choice. I think later on the zoning took over and you didn't have the choice to go. I used to get the bus. There was Hastings Girls actually, went by bus right through to Napier, but I think there came a time when you didn't have the choice to do that. I think probably two people had to go to Hastings, because my siblings all went to Hastings. I often think that was a very good way to get to high school, because half the time I did my homework going on the bus. Of course, that was the year of the polio epidemic when I started high school, and we had to do a certain amount of correspondence. And going to Manga Territory, I never had the knowledge of an intermediate school. So going to high school was a bit of a cultural shock for me, because of having to go to different rooms, different teachers, all that sort of thing, whereas at Manga Territory had the same teacher. It's quite a shock, isn't it? And it took a while to get used to. But you see, with me, I was able to integrate myself into the community by, on rainy days, I'd play the piano down in the hall and the girls would dance. So, you know, it was something that has always got me into a wider circle.
And did you play any sports when you were at high school?
I played basketball, or netball they call it now, at Manga Territory. Played a little bit of it at high school, but I was never not a shining star at any of that at all. I wouldn't say that I played it a lot, but it was enough to get me by, I suppose. No, I wouldn't say I played a lot of sport. I never liked cricket. I could have played cricket, but I never liked it. So it was really just the basketball that I had any interest in at all. But tennis, I liked tennis.
But you're still playing the piano and getting better at that, obviously.
Yes, yes.
Because, you know, later on you played for dances and that sort of thing.
Well, you see, I played by ear, but Mum did send me to a tutor. She was a very spinsterish old lady who was very classical-minded, and she said to my mother eventually, "I don't think I can do any more with your daughter. She is jazzing remembrance." And, I mean, I didn't think I was, but obviously she could detect a rhythm. There wasn't much point in me carrying on. Although I did carry on with another tutor for a wee while, but he was a male, and I didn't actually like him very much, so I stopped going with him too. So I stopped learning, but I had learnt enough to get me through the basics of reading music if I needed to. But I spent most of my time playing by ear, so it was quite good. But when I think I turned 15, I really was fed up with school. I didn't want to keep going to school. I wanted to go and earn some money, and I started pestering my parents to leave school. No, you've got to keep going. Your education's got to keep going. But anyhow, in the end I won, because I was offered a job on Wakatū Works office in town. I think probably the truth's known. Dad would have whispered in somebody's ear that our eldest daughter is driving us mad wanting to go to work, and we don't know what to do about it. Well, she can have a job in the office anyway. That's how I sort of think. Otherwise, the fact that I could get work made it possible. But I could leave school on the proviso that I kept going to night school to learn shorthand typing. So, okay, I agreed that I would go to night school to learn shorthand typing. So I would go into Napier week after week to go to night school. But as it turned out, the job I was given, not initially, but eventually, was the borough's bookkeeping machine in the works office that worked out all the men's wages. I didn't need shorthand typing. And I loved that machine. I mean, again, I think I worked out a rhythm in that machine.
So that's where you picked up your accounting skills to go and work at Inland Revenue.
Yeah. Anyhow, I used to bike into town with my next door neighbour. Her name was Bev Hay, and she worked at De Palaszczuk MacLeod. And she went there, and I went to the office in Paramore Road then. Well, anyhow, the wage I was getting was, I think, £2 something, about £2.50 or something a week. And I bought myself a bike, a nice sporty bike, etc. And then Bev Hay had said to me one day, you could get a job at De Palaszczuk and they pay more. Oh, that was interesting, paying more. So anyhow, as it turned out, I did go to the Palaszczuk, and I can't remember how much more they paid. Probably it wasn't a great deal, but anyhow, I like working there too. So I like working in both places, and the staff around me were, you know, all friendly people. It was quite interesting later on when the Whakatū Works closed, and I had actually worked in the office with Ian Cameron, that was the manager at the time it closed, because he was much younger then. And I remember talking to him about the closure, and he said he was very, very bitter about it. He begged the powers that be to keep at least two chains going, but they wouldn't. They said the infrastructure was too old and that it wasn't viable, etc. He felt that was just excuses, but of course it was devastating to the workforce. God. And he vowed that he would never go through that place again, never go through Whakatū again, and he didn't. Well, I mean, see, Dad had to give up work. He eventually ended up by being the supervisor of the outside staff, and he would have worked on maintenance and all that sort of thing around the place. And he had a great affinity for the works, and he had to give it up when he actually had a stroke. But he kept going back and having a cuppa with the men and all that sort of thing. Mm. He missed it a great deal. They had a sort of camaraderie, really, didn't they? Most of them got on very well together. I think one of the Maori men has written a book about the slaughter board, men on the slaughter board, Chaptamona. Yes. The closure of Whakatū was devastating, but even more so when Tamona closed. So it meant a great deal to the Hawke's Bay. Well, I have often wondered if, I mean, I know there had been a fair bit of dissension at times with the union and the men who were sort of behind the union. I can still remember Dad complaining that when he went to speak at a union meeting, he was told he was out of order. He wasn't allowed to speak. So I think they became a little bit too powerful. And I had often wondered if there was something behind that as well, you know, with the closure, that they didn't only want the expense of replenishing the infrastructure, but they didn't want anything to do with the union either. So, you know, you can sort of read between the lines and wonder just how much was behind it.
The Palaszczuk MacLeods, those would be the days when Charlie Webb was running the garage and Matt Tweedy was an apprentice at the garage.
Matt Tweedy, yes. Who married Carol Lambert. Well, you see, I used to walk to school with the Lambert girls.
So where did the Lamberts live then?
They lived in Watson Road. They lived there. We were in the next row, and they had an orchard. I remember Carol Lambert telling me, some time later, of course, we were talking about the farmer's building in Hastings here, and she said that her father, I think, had told her that it was built on rollers.
That's why it survived.
Well, so did the Inland Revenue Building in Napier. Yes. That was on rollers.
And one of the banks in Hastings was too.
Yes.
Might have been the ANZ.
Because being on the fifth floor at Inland Revenue was like being in a palm tree. My sister and Lois and Rob and Nan, well, they're great friends with Jim Tweedy, or were, because I think Robin worked with Jim, and I still see Mavis off and on. I used to go to the dances that were held in the, I can't remember, Hastings.
Premier?
No, not the Premier.
Assembly?
Where the donut shop used to be, that hall had a name. There was always dances there, and we used to get the bus in from Wakatu, the Ratsy Girls and myself, and sometimes Valerie Anderson. And we used to go to these dances, but we always had to, the last bus went at, I think it was about 11 o'clock at night, so we always had to leave the dance early to catch the bus.
Yes.
But anyhow, that's where I met my first husband, at one of those dances. And his name was Owen Start. He had just come back to Hastings, apparently, from the South Island. He'd been working in the South Island deer culling, and had just had not long been back in Hastings. And his parents lived down in Gascoigne Street. And, I mean, I was only a teenager.
Yes.
I was, I think, around about 16 I started going to those dances. But I was going to work in Hastings as well. But he was much older than me. But anyhow, he started cornering me at the dances. He couldn't dance for peanuts, but still he still liked to dance. And my friend June Rapsey, who's now gone down south, she married John Crooks, but he's died now, and she's gone down south to live with their daughter. But anyhow, she used to have all of these blokes just about lining up to dance with her. But she was a natural, she was good looking, but she was a natural, almost flirting. She didn't think she was flirting. And I used to look at her, how on earth does she do that? Some people, it comes to
natural,
them naturally. But anyhow, Owen started sort of actually pegging me down and asked me one time, would I go to the pictures with him? Oh, I said, no, I wasn't sure. I'd have to ask my parents. And he got a shock when I told him I was 16. He was 25. But anyhow, that was all right. They said I could go to the pictures with this guy. As long as I got the bus home. Which I did do, and of course, I'd never been on a date. I had never been on a date. It was all very, very new to me, and the box of chocolates he bought me at half time went home to Mum. But anyhow, we started going out together, and Dad, particularly Dad, disapproved. He did not like him. In the first place, he was too old for me. In the second place, he didn't have a regular job, and he didn't appear to have any prospects. Mum had known his father from Napier days. They used to call him Seaman Start. He was a merchant seaman. So Dad put two and two together. Oh yeah, right, yeah. They both float from one thing to another.
Yes.
But anyhow, I liked him. Even though he couldn't dance, I liked him. And so in the end, Dad put his foot down. He says no, he didn't think that a kid of my age should be going out with a grown man. So, of course, then they insisted that I stop seeing him. I kicked up a fuss, of course. I was a teenager, wasn't I? So, anyhow, they promised me that if I didn't see him for a year, they would rethink the situation. So I didn't have much choice but to agree, because I knew they could actually stop me going
That's
into
right.
town and all that sort
That's
of thing.
Right.
I then became a teenage martyr. Okay, I went out with girlfriends and all that sort of thing. But we eventually got together again, and we eventually got married. In those days, of course, you don't have to, I think now, once you turn 18, you're an adult. Not sure if it was the case then, in the 1950s. Anyhow, they agreed that, okay, if that's what I still wanted to do, then that was my choice. But anyhow, we were quite happy for a number of years. And he became interested in rock hunting and lapidary work. And I became interested in it too. He actually was quite good at it. You know, he knew how to use the machinery, and he made rock pendants and all that sort of thing. And it was the thing to do in those days. So we actually had quite a good time doing that. But he was another person that also, the grass was always greener on the other side, and so we were constantly changing jobs and constantly moving. And I started to actually see what Dad had seen. Meanwhile, so, I mean, it's a case of You can't put an old head on young shoulders. And even by the time I was 21, I still wasn't convinced that I'd made a wrong choice. It took me a long time to realise. Sure. He was a good man in a lot of ways, but he was also a bad manager of things. He was not good with money. He always thought that, you know, as I say, the grass was greener, and always thought that the fortune was going to be made on the next property sort of thing. It never was.
Did you have any children?
Yeah, we had three kids. I had two boys and a girl, Gary, and then Beverly, and then Kevin. And they've all been good kids. Gary joined the Air Force, and so did Kevin, but he didn't stay in as long as Gary did. Kevin even went down to Antarctica with the Air Force at one stage.
Yes.
Beverly, she was a nurse and still is nursing. So they've been three good kids. I don't know how they managed to actually grow up by moving from one place to another, which they did have to do quite often, but they survived it.
And were you working while you were moving?
Yes. Well, some of the time I was. Yes. At one part of it, he decided he'd like to go share milking. Oh, God, I hated that job. Oh, God. But I can still remember being a midwife to a cow. Oh, I thought it was terrible. Oh, but anyhow, we got through that. But again, it was not a good management thing because we were share milking 70-30. We were the 30. Yeah. And we were doing all the hard work for 30%. Right. So that was not good management because it was his decision.
Was this locally? Or?
No, this was up at Maikato. So I don't know. Well, initially we worked for the McCarty family down at Taramana, and they were great people to work for.
Yeah.
I honestly don't think he was one of these people that could turn his hand to anything, but he was never master of anything. So he would do some jobs very well, and then he would do something else terrible that would end up by the boss saying, "God, get rid of you," sort of thing. Mm. What he did was, at Aramana, was they used to have the tidal creek going through the property, and they loaned him the farm ute to go in and out of town or whatever, which was good. But he tried to ford the tidal creek with the ute, and it was high tide. He wrote it off. Oh, so, you know, things like that he would do. And I liked it out there. It was lovely. And we didn't have electricity, but we had a kerosene fridge. The stove was one of the modern coal ranges that had the thermostat on the oven and all that sort of thing. I mean, it was a nice house we were given to live in. Yeah. So, no, it was. I really enjoyed out there.
So at some stage it all fell apart, obviously.
I don't know whether it was the ute thing that caused it or what it was, but anyhow, in the end we were leaving, and I never quite cottoned on to why we were leaving. Probably got the sack if the truth's known. I don't know. But anyhow, we went up to the Waikato, and he worked in a milk factory there for a while, and then we got the share milking job. Oh, God. I'll never forget that. Again, things seemed to go wrong with them, and I honestly do not think he was the sort of man that should have been on the land. All the calves that were born got some sort of sickness. So whether it was his fault, I honestly do not know. No. But might have been just bad luck. The owner wasn't very happy. So we moved again to Mount Maunganui. And then he took up working as a painter and paper hanger. Now, I've got no idea how he learnt to be a painter and paper hanger, but he did it. That's what I mean. He could turn his hand to anything, but I don't know that he could do it all as a master. He was good mechanic. He could fix an old car, but we were always poor because we had old cars and things like that. So in the end, I think the marriage was starting to get a bit weak. But anyhow, we carried on. He did certain things that I can't even talk about, like he swanned off to Australia at one stage without me even knowing, you know. And then he comes back as if nothing had happened. And I'm thinking, what sort of guy are you? Mm. I thought I had trust in you, but now I haven't. There's no trust. Once trust goes out the door, you've had it. So in the end, we separated. But again, again, it was my fault. Because, I mean, I still carried on playing piano. If I could be in a dance band, I was. And he used to complain that he had to make an appointment to see his wife. Yeah, right. So at least I'm earning some money.
So at some stage then you went back to work.
Oh yes, I did work wherever I could get work. I did. When we were down south, I worked in an accountant's office. We went down to Greymouth because he had been offered a job in a greenstone factory. And of course he had been doing lapidary work.
Right.
That suited him nicely. And he was far better off the land anyhow. He worked in this greenstone factory. And I went to work for an accountant in Greymouth. And we started off in Hokitika, then moved up to Greymouth later. And we bought an older house. It was on leasehold land, but we bought this older house at Renunga, just out of Greymouth. And again, I went to the local pub and played the piano and enjoyed that. It was fun in Greymouth. Because of my playing, everybody knew who I was and everyone would speak to me, even if it was just hello. And I played with men who were in the Greymouth brass band. They could loan themselves to the dance band. So we played at all sorts of venues and played for football dances, rugby clubs and all that sort of thing. And I always remember, I talk about the West Coast as being very parochial, and they are, very much so. Yeah. And I remember saying to one guy, he asked me one night at one of the functions we were at, "Where do you come from?" He said, I come from Hawke's Bay. "Oh, yeah." I said, "Have you ever been up there, up north?" He says, "Nah." And I said, "Do you ever want to go up north?" "Nah." He wasn't interested.
Yes, he'd have an opinion, though.
Yeah. They were quite happy in their own little place. Yes, the time I was playing in the... I can't remember the name of the hotel. I can still see it, but I can't remember. And I think it was 10 o'clock closing time at the time. And I was playing the piano and the local cop walked in. And I froze. Oh, God, we're going to end up in jail. But nobody took any notice. He just walked in, had a look around. And walked out again. And I sort of said, "How? Aren't we breaking the law?" "No, we've all signed the book." I thought, "Well, I haven't signed a book." It really amazed me, the way of life down there. It just is a law unto itself, virtually.
Oh.
I don't know whether it's still the same. But I made some good friends there, and I still keep contact with some of them. But they are so, they're very parochial. If you haven't been there for 50 years, then you're still a stranger.
So then when you eventually came back to Hawke's Bay, your husband had gone.
Yes, he stayed down there. In the end, we agreed to disagree. I was worried about our youngest son. He was still at high school when we were down there. The other two were off doing their own thing, but he was still at high school. And I was worried about what was going to happen to him as far as any career was concerned. There wasn't much going in Greymouth at all. So I said to him, "I want to go back up north. I think Kevin needs to have a decent job, etc." And he says, "I don't want to go back up there. I want to stay down here." And he did have a couple of friends over in Christchurch that he'd had for a long time. Anyhow, I said, "Well, I think it's time that we made a decision then." We knew we weren't getting on all that well. We were virtually like brother and sister then. Our marriage had disintegrated. And so I decided that, yes, I would come back. So I rang my mother and asked her if it was all right if I came back to her house initially, because Dad had died. And yes, she was quite happy about that, if that's what I wanted to do. So anyhow, it was up to Kevin to decide what he wanted to do. Did he want to stay down in Greymouth or come back with me? "No, I'll come back with you." So that's what he did. When we got back up north, he got a job in the parts department. And funny enough, he's always been into doing that sort of thing right from the beginning. It was in a garage in the parts department. I can't remember the name that he went to in Hastings. But then he decided that he too would like to go into the Air Force. So he applied, and I can't remember how many years he did do. But again, it was doing that sort of job with parts and that sort of thing. And so I don't know how he managed it, but he got the opportunity to go down on a trip down to Antarctica with one of the planes. So that was a big experience for him. And both boys had always played brass instruments. And he had played in the Greymouth band. Gary had played in the Hastings band, and he actually went into some competition at one stage. He played the fugal horn, and he got a recommendation for his piece that he played, so that was good. He did well with that, but ever since he hasn't played that sort of instrument, but he does play guitar, and he had a very good singing voice. He actually did a stint with the Fribs at one stage. So anyhow, when we came back here, I tried to get back into De Palaszczuk's actually, because I think they were still operating then. But as it turned out, it's funny how things work out for you. Sometimes fate almost steps in. And De Palaszczuk's rang me back and said, no, I didn't get the position that I'd applied for. So I decided I'd go to the Labour Department. I went to the Labour Department and they said that there was a position at Inland Revenue as a filing clerk. And I thought, filing clerk? And the guy said to me, get your foot in the door. So anyhow, I decided I'd go. And I got the job. And of course, I ended up by... I didn't like filing. By any means, I didn't like filing. So in the end, I did do a stint behind counter and didn't know much about tax, but I soon learned. And then I got the job in the administration part, and I stayed there for 20-odd years. Yeah. So the fact that I'd tried to go to Palaszczuk's, that fate stepped in. Yeah, so anyhow, I stayed with my mother for some time. But I used to also, before I'd left Hastings Napier area, I had been playing piano for the Terradale RSA Concert Party. And that's how I first knew my second husband. He played violin with the concert party. But then, of course, I went down south and was down there a couple of years. And when I came back, I slotted in again into the concert party. They'd had a pianist, but I think she must have had to leave or something happened in here. So I got back into the concert party again, and sort of things just seemed to take over. And I was also playing piano out at the Union Pub in Ahuriri. Yes. And so was he. He was playing violin out there.
So you were together?
We virtually were. So in the end, we decided to get together.
And so is he a local person?
Ken, yes. His father, although he was born down in Belcova, he also somehow got up here and was an Otani. And Ken was born an Otani. But his father, Gilbert Mackay, married, I think, three times. His first wife, he was married to Rosina Collins, and the Collins family had a big farm out at Otani. But she died young. She'd had some children, but I don't know what went wrong with her. Quite funny, because one of the photos I've got of Rosina and Gilbert came from the Belcluther reunion. Anyhow, after that, he married another lady, can't remember her name now at the moment, but she did have a little daughter, Phyllis, her name was, and again that lady died, I think, in childbirth. She died in childbirth, but Phyllis, her daughter, was brought up as a Mackay, and she was always known as a Mackay. Yes. But there is another family lineage for her. I think Phyllis herself did have a daughter as well. But anyhow, Ken's mother was the third wife, and she had Nolan and Ken and a daughter who played piano. She also played out at the Union Pub. And Don Mackay was the youngest one. He played piano a lot around too. He was well known in Hastings for playing. In fact, the Mackay band apparently was well known for many years.
Well, Noel Mackay?
Nolan.
Was he a violinist or a pianist?
No, Nolan played violin.
Did he have the band?
He might have been under his name. I think Ken played saxophone at that time in the band, and Don or his sister would have played piano. Would have been either or, probably. And the father, Gilbert, he played, you could say it was Scottish fiddle, played that style, and they often used to play it, the Scottish, whatever they call it. So he was local. But Gilbert and his wife, Myrtle, eventually moved into Hastings. But he was, again, Otani, a bigwig for quite some time. Sure. He was in Parliament. He was a Member of Parliament for a stage. And also on the Harbour Board, Hospital Board, and all that sort of thing. He was one of those sorts of people. And so Ken was brought up in Hastings. And his high school first day was the earthquake. And he said he was undergoing the initiation, apparently, at that time. The initiation was running the gauntlet and the blue bag. And apparently you get dabbed with the blue bag. So when the earthquake happened, they used to live in Ellison Road. He ran home after they were able to escape. and he still had the blue face, and his mother nearly had a heart attack when she saw him. Yeah. It was quite a day for his high school initiation. He stayed there for, I don't know whether he got right through high school or not, I can't remember now. But anyhow, his father got him a job at the hospital, in the hospital office, and he didn't like it. So then he tried a job in the grocery shop, and he wasn't very keen on that. In the end, he got into an engineer's workshop, the farmer's workshop, and that's where he learned his engineering, and that was the thing that he did in the Air Force. When he joined the Air Force, he was an engineer fixing planes, went over to the islands during the war.
So that would have been Albert Farmery's workshop. Doug was the son.
Yeah, Albert Farmery. That's where he did his apprenticeship for engineering. One of his memories was driving the steam engine. Albert Farmery must have had one of these. Yes. And Ken was driving this machine along the road and ended up in a ditch. So that wasn't a very good memory, apparently.
No.
He had the musical ability as well as the engineering mechanical ability as well. So he ended up in Bailey Motors. But he was down in the Air Force thing at Fielding.
Oh, have you?
Yeah, went overseas. He had a bad accident before he went. He was in the undercarriage inspecting some work that some of the workmen had done on this plane. And Ken was underneath inspecting it. And the pilot, because he thought that everything was fixed, very excitedly got into the cockpit and started the engine up, and the plane fell off its chocks, and Ken copped it. He apparently got broken ribs. I can't remember now how long he had to actually recover, but he wanted to go overseas, do an overseas stint, and he was frightened that this occasion was going to put the kibosh on it. But anyhow, he recovered in time. But what they did over there, because it was the heat of the sun and all that sort of thing, he used to get one of his mates to rub his back with engine oil, and he would go around shirtless, and the engine oil would sort of seep into his skin, and it was almost as if it was like a heated blanket around him, and that helped him mend. Strange, isn't it? So he did his stint, got mentioned in dispatches, etc., for what he'd done, different things. But he said he never could get over the fact that one of the guys that was in his unit was breaking his neck to get home to his family. He had a young family, and the war was coming to a close, and he eventually was allowed to go home, but the plane went down. Ken says he's never been able to get over that, because he could see this man was so desperate to get back to his family, and I think he might have actually questioned the work of God.
So at some stage you married Ken, and you had Phyllis.
No, Phyllis was his half-sister. She virtually turned out to be like a surrogate mother to him. So no, Ken and I never had any children.
You carried on both playing?
Yes, Ken had a house in Trevelyan Street because his first wife, they divorced, and his first wife moved out of the house. He was on his own for possibly 10 years, quite some time before we married. So it was just one of those things that we just sort of had a good companionship, and we went all over the place together, and we'd go to shows and all that sort of thing. And he always played golf. He was a very good golf player, and the day he died he played golf. He came home from a golf game, and I can't remember exactly just how, must have been during the night, that's right, I woke up and he was in pain. He'd been backwards and forwards, apparently, down to the bathroom, and he had this terrible pain in his back, and I really didn't know what to do with him. I said, did you have something to eat out at the golf course that you shouldn't have? He said, no, I didn't have anything that anyone else didn't have. He said, I don't think it's something I ate. So in the end, I said, well, maybe we should call the emergency service, the ambulance or something. No, it'll go. Oh, God. So in the end, the pain seemed to be getting worse. In the end, he agreed that I should call the emergency doctor. And as it turned out, I can't remember which doctor it was now, but he was very good. He came to the house, and I think he virtually pinpointed straight away. Ken had an aneurysm, an aortic aneurysm, and it didn't mean anything to me. You know, I didn't know what it was all about. But the doctor knew. Apparently, they're very hard to diagnose, but he did. Got the ambulance and got Ken to hospital, and they got him on the operating table, but it was too late. They couldn't save him. They tried. They pumped blood into him. They couldn't. it was too late. I often think now that I should have got the emergency doctor sooner, but it was him saying, no, no, it'll go. He was 79. It was a big shock to me because he was so fit.
So how long ago was that?
That was 96.
And so you worked for how long?
Strangely enough, they did a big restructure at Inland Revenue. Yes. And I was one that was made redundant,
yes,
mostly because I was near a retiring
sure
age. Okay, mm-hmm, I still had a couple of years to go to the super, but I was able to get the super with Ken, and I did get a redundancy pay, but I think it was a case of the government departments all doing that sort of thing at the
sure
time, getting rid of staff, making the ones that stayed work harder type of thing. So that was in the June. And of course, Ken and I had great plans of going travelling again, doing something else in the
sure
car, but he died in November.
You had some interest in genealogy and so forth. You had a long interest in that.
Oh, yes. Interest. I mean, genealogy has been one of the mainstays of in getting to know extended family that I didn't
yeah
have a clue
sure
about, that sort of thing. But I have, you know, kept active and still retain some contact with the Taradale RSA. Still go out there to the women's section, mm, and we had a lot of fun on that concert party. It was a wonderful time. I now and again get back to see them, and I'm still happy that they're able to keep going. So no, I still keep active as much as I can, and I've often done quite a bit of writing, family stuff mostly, but I did do a stint of fictional writing, going to a group that we virtually monitored ourselves. But no, I've kept in social contact with people. I moved back over to Hastings mostly because I knew that the Napier House needed a lot of TLC.
And this is the home you moved to?
Yeah. It was a case of, I knew that if Ken had lived, he wouldn't have wanted to move. He would have liked to stay where he was. But the fact that I was left on my own and having to service an older house, that was really the... And coming back to Hastings, where I was born.
You've been everywhere,
yeah,
though, haven't you?
Yeah. Well, yes, I've been all over. I mean, I've done a couple of world trips. My daughter got married. She married a Dutchman. That was in 77. And I decided I would take some leave from IRD and go to her wedding. Ken and I weren't married then. So another friend came with me as a companion. She'd done a lot of travel. So the two of us swanned off to Holland because my daughter had decided that, I mean, she'd been in the UK. She'd been in London for some time doing nannying. But she decided when she met this Dutchman that because his family wanted him to marry there, she said, okay, that was fine with her as long as they came back to New Zealand to live. And he was fine with that. So that's what happened. I went over to Holland for their wedding, which was a big experience for me. It was very different, but it was a lot of fun. I stayed in his parents' house. My daughter lived around the corner at one of his sister's houses. They couldn't speak English. Jan, her fiancé, could, but I wouldn't say he was a great communicator by any means. So his mother and I had to talk to each other sign language. And I still remember her saying to us one time, we went down for breakfast. They had a two-story house and went down to breakfast. And she was trying to ask me, she was pointing to the washing machine. They had one of those washing machines, front loader ones,
yes,
it was in the kitchen. And she was pointing to this washing machine and pointing to the tea towel. And Ev and I were sitting at the breakfast table saying, what did she say? And talking, you know,
yes,
together. I don't know. Is she saying something about, have we got any washing? Or what's she pointing at the tea towel for? Don't know. Anyhow, in the end, we got frustrated. And I said, I don't know. We've shook our heads, you see. And she says, wait, Bevy. In other words, wait for Beverly to come round. They knew she would be
yes
coming round. Because she had learnt some
yes
Dutch.
Yes.
So she came round and we tried to explain to her what the mother-in-law was trying to tell us. She said, what do you think she was asking you? We said, do we wash our tea towels in the washing machine? No, Mum. What she's saying is, will you bring your towels down to be washed? Oh, but we've hardly used our towels. That doesn't make any difference to her. She's always washing anyhow. It was typical Dutch, I suppose,
yes,
washing everything. And because we had a laugh about this. And she said to Beverly, your mother should learn to speak Dutch. And Beverly said, why do you think my mother should learn to speak Dutch? Well, she's clever. She works for tax department. Oh yeah, right. Clever working for the tax department. Why can't you learn to speak English? Oh no, I'm not clever.
So grandchildren?
Beverly and Jan had a daughter and twin sons. Those are three very good kids, very clever kids. The boys are, you can say, computer nerds. It was discovered when they were born that they had an issue with protein. It's called PKU or something like that. It's apparently a recessive gene that's passed on from the parents. Mm. It has to be passed on from both parents, funnily enough, and yet it hasn't occurred in any of our other children. So it's been quite a mystery. And the only thing we can think of is that it's come from the Irish side, because Jan has got Irish blood in him too. Mm. So those kids, you can more or less say that they have to be vegetarians. They can't take too much protein. Right. They have to have measured protein, because you have to have that to grow, apparently.
That's right.
They've never really eaten meat. And Angela now, because she's well in her 30s now, when her mates say to her, when she's out with them, why don't you have, you know, this piece of pork or fish or something like that, she said her answer now is, no, I don't like it. It's no good her trying to explain why she can't have it.
These are things that people can live with today as long as they know.
Yes, and the fact that she's a nurse and understands it perfectly and is able to get through to them to understand it, it's something that if it hadn't been for science, those poor kids would have been backward now. And that's why I've got so much respect for science.
Now, can you think of anything else? I think we've pretty well covered everything.
Yes, I think so. Well, the fact that Angela's got two boys, the twins have never married. One of the twins has got a girlfriend, but they've not married. Angela is the one who's married and got these two boys. But one of the things that is, I think, something that she needs to be recommended for is that she's had some health problems herself. She had a stroke as a young woman, which she's recovered pretty well from, and she's also had some cancer detected, which she seems to have got rid of that at this stage, hopefully she has. But what she has done is taken on board a little girl who actually is related to her husband. In other words, he's probably her half-sister. The father had this child to another woman, and the father is not a good father. He's been an alcoholic and all that sort of thing. Anyhow, this child was being virtually dragged up by him, and she became in the care of Sips. And Sips tracked down her lineage and found Angela and Anton. They had a stable family, and asked if they would take this child on to give her some stable home. Anyhow, in the end, and I think it was with my daughter's help too, they decided yes they would, and I think they've now adopted her. So the fact that with all her health problems she's had, she's taken this little girl on board, and she's now about 8 or 9 now. And Angela has always been very horsified. She loves horses, and she's ridden quite a bit herself in gymkhanas and that sort of thing. And so she's imparted this onto the child. And this little girl is horsified. So she's riding and doing quite well, handling horses and that sort of thing. So from being virtually a child that was destined for nothing much at all, she's now got a future ahead of her.
Well, that's a nice way to end the story of Shirley and her family. So thank you, Shirley, for that. That's wonderful. Tell me the rest of the story.
I just wanted to mention that both my sons, Gary and Kevin, they have both had families. And Gary had two sons, but he's also married twice. And so he has got two daughters as well from that marriage. Well, stepdaughters they are. He's also got grandchildren from them. So they're living over in Perth now. So I don't hear a great deal from him. It's nice when he does ring, but we've sort of lost a lot of contact with his children and his family. So there's nothing much we can do about it if the kids got their own lives. So there's nothing much we can do. But I do have contact with my younger son's children. They both live here in Hawke's Bay. My younger son lives in Rotorua now, Kevin. But they come down occasionally to visit their family. But my grandson, Keith, he has become a chef, and he's not married, but he likes cooking. So it's nice to have a cook in the family. Yep. And his sister Nicole, she's got two little girls and she's in a new relationship which seems to be going well. So that's sort of a run-up on the grandchildren.
Okay, no, that's great.